Greetings and salutations, everyone. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I am the net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. It's been going on and on and on for over 44 years. Every Sunday night at around 8 o'clock, we sit in front of our radios, and we chat a bit. We inform each other. We learn from each other, and hopefully we entertain each other. And I thank you once again for joining me this Sunday night at 8 p.m. To try it all over again. Let me drop for a second, and I'll give you the usual links. If you need to reach me via email, that would be for mailbag questions or TechNet puzzles or volunteering to explain a technical aspect that's in the news, or if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and have him take a look at a NASA or space-related story, my email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. And if you want to go directly to Paul, Paul's is spacenetreport@gmail.com. Also, as always, I maintain a list of links of interesting articles and YouTubes that I've seen throughout the week, and I publish them weekly, and I keep them up forever and ever and ever. So if you have a case of insomnia and want to read some articles I found interesting, go to your browser, type roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to the link page. We also have a link to go to the chat room. Sometimes the chat room is busy. Sometimes it's quiet. You can get to it by typing into your browser, chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll land you there. We offer a audio stream on the Internet of the Technical Net, and I keep it live the rest of the week because a few people ask me, so that you can listen in to the Glen Oaks repeater any old time when you don't have a radio connection. So that's technet.ac2gs.com. Also, I'd like to remind everyone that MikeKC2NJI has an archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv. It's been up for a long time now. It's had over a million visitors, and it has a collection of Limark technical nets that go as far back as September of 2006. So avail yourself of the wisdom of people who have either moved out of the area or unfortunately become silent keys over the years. So that's that. Let me drop for a second, and I'll come back and tell you the plan for tonight.
KF2ZZ online.
Okay, Brian, recognized. We'll let me get through my little spiel, and then we'll take questions and comments and topics. Anyway, standard operating session tonight. We don't have any guest speakers. I have very little to say about AI for a change. It's not been a very newsy week. Then we will go on to the questions, comments, and topics. I'll ask people to submit if they have any questions or topics or comments to be made. Initially, maybe amateur radio related, because this is an amateur radio repeater and we're all amateur radio operators, but we'll discuss any science and or technology-based subject as the night progresses. So best to get your name down early so it's there. Although, last week, unfortunately, we didn't get to one person because the first two questions took up the entire time of our segment. Anyway, that should take us approximately to 10:15, and Paul, WS2N, will join us for the SpaceNet report, which should take us approximately to 11 p.m. And I will return to tie a bow on everything and wish you well for the coming week. So that's the plan. If my shack continues to work right and the repeater continues to work right and I don't get thrown off of All-Star too many times. So that's the plan. So let me drop and I'll give you my little 2 cents worth about AI for the week. Okay, as I mentioned before, there really was almost nothing in the news. You know, they're still writing articles about bubbles and we'll see how that goes. There was a very small story that kind of got blown up. Apparently, a unemployed actress as a public relations, a PR stunt, made an announcement that she had a artificial intelligence-based synthetic actress available for bookings. I don't think any booking agent called her, but I'm the union, the actors union, had a lot to say about it, and none of it was particularly good. So they got an opportunity to flex on the internet and the news services and such. Otherwise, nothing much going on there. So with that in mind, let's move on to our main first segment, questions, comments, and topics. If anyone has any, please hit that push to talk. Give me your frame, your call sign, whether it's amateur radio related or non-amateur radio related.
W2BZ radio related.
KD2VHD, Jim, radio related.
KF2CZ, amateur related.
AD2DU, which Christmas lights to buy for no interference on the radio?
Okay, Rich recognized, Jim recognized, Brian recognized, and Alex recognized. Anyone else want to put your name down on the list for tonight? Okay, I'll take that as not quite, not now, but maybe later. Rich, what do you got for us tonight?
Yeah, good night. Good evening, Roy, and everybody else. I've been thinking about SWR. We're always thinking about SWR. And we're always chasing the perfect SWR. But if you have an SWR of, let's say, 1.5 to 1, and that gets increased to 2 to 1, what is the actual difference in S units for the receiving station? Go ahead.
Okay, you can't really do that. I know you'd like to, and everyone else would. We've talked about this repeatedly, that the reason why everyone is so focused on standing wave ratios or VSWRs is that you could actually measure them, and you can't measure easily the radio energy that's coming off of your antenna, which is the important thing to approximate changes in your S-meter readings given the baseline of the guy on the other end of the antenna. So if it doesn't correlate. You can have a VSWR of 1 to 1 and have an S7 signal, or you can have an S3 signal. Again, all that the VSWR is telling you is the match between your transmitter, your antenna system, and the better it is, the closer it is to 1 to 1, the more energy you are transferring from your transmitter to the antenna that may or may not radiate. Again, a dummy load has, by almost definition, a perfect VSWR, but you're not going to use it as an antenna because it has no radiation resistance. It consumes everything as thermal heat, not RF creation. So you can't really go like that. What you can say is if you have a device, an antenna system that has an SWR of ISWA of 2 to 1, and if the transmission line is relatively loss-free, which is a theoretical construct, every transmission line has some non-zero insertion loss, but if for the sake of whatever that it didn't, you would only have about 11 or 12% decrease in your total power output just going from a VSWR of 1 to 1 to 2 to 1.
Well, how does that translate for the guy on the receiving end? There must be some correlation it could make if, all else remains the same, and the only thing, your power is, let's say, 50 watts, and you, on purpose, detune your radio from a 2 to 1 to 1.5 to 1, it's hardly noticeable, right, on the receiving end?
Yeah, it's hardly noticeable. You have to keep in mind that for a legally set up S meter, you would need to have a drop of, go down to 25% of your previous signal strength for the guy on the receiving end to approximately see a 1S unit decrease. By the way, I think John wanted to say something. So, John, what do you want to say?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that I think the comparison that it's making is that everything else stays the same. The line loss stays the same. Path loss stays the same. Everything stays the same. The only difference is that we change the SWR from 1.5 to 1 to 2 to 1. The units of dB per S unit, 6 dB per S unit, I think a change, I haven't gone through the math, but a change from 1.5 to 1 to 2 to 1 SWR, I don't even think would show up on an average S meter. It is such a small change. But, I mean, the change from 1.5 to 1 to 2 to 1 means that there, or the power radiated is going to be something less. And that something less can be quantified into dB loss. And I suspect it's like a fraction of a dB. Go ahead.
Yeah, I agree with you, John. But you know, unfortunately, the theoretical is the easiest place to talk about. Because if you talk in the practical world, the attenuation losses of a given coaxial cable, they're different. You know, some of them have an insertion loss of 1 dB for 100 feet. Others at the same frequency, it could be, you know, 4 or 5 dB for 100 feet, and that factors into the loss due to reflections back and forth due to, higher viswas. So, you know, in the real world, it's not an easy equation. You can't just plug in the numbers and tell people. And yeah, it would be a fraction of an S unit. I was mentioning that you would have to drop your power down to only 25% previously to see your S meter deflect one less S unit. So you can imagine that 12% diminution, how minuscule that S meter is, just kind of twitching.
Yeah, exactly. It's 6 dB per S unit, so that's in half and in half again. 3 dB is half power, so another half power is 6 dB. So 6 dB per S unit. So as you say, I don't think it would even be noticeable.
Yeah, we agree. Back to you, Rich.
Yeah, so if you increase the SWR from 1.5 to 2, is that harder on the finals? Does that strain your radio? Or let's say 1.5 to 3 to 1, is that in any way damaging to your radio? Go ahead.
It can damage your radio. The problem is not in the diminution of the power that gets to your radiating antenna. The problem with a high viswa is that the power gets reflected back into the circuitry of the transmitter unless you do something about it. That's why modern day transmitters are capable of sensing reverse current, and they will clip down the gain of the transmitter to a much lower level so as not to damage the components of the transmitter. So the reflect transmitters have to deal with.
What does reflected power do to a transmitter?
It can blow out circuits.
I mean, that has to be 25 to 1 type of thing, right?
No, you can screw up a transmitter long before you have a viswa of 25 to 1. My linear amplifier will simply not tolerate anything higher than a 1.5. It'll squeal like a pig.
Really, a 1.5, so a 1.7, and your linear won't work?
Yeah, but that's just the engineer's decision of how to make it as safe as humanly possible, I guess. He assumed that, you know, you could always use a antenna tuner to transform the impedance to something a little bit better than a 1.5. So that's my limit with the Expert Systems linear amplifier. Anything past 1.5 and it squeals and goes into bypass mode.
So I guess what it's doing is protecting the finals, right?
Right.
Okay. The next thing is I use a reverse beacon network a lot, you know, to see where my signal is getting to. And it always lists a signal-to-noise ratio. And I was just, you know, and of course, the closer the monitoring station is to me, the better my signal-to-noise ratio is. But, for instance, the last list is 19, 14, 21, 26, and a lot of times they're in single digits if you're going over to Europe and all that. How do you know what is a, or how do you translate signal-to-noise ratio into dB on an S-meter? Go ahead.
Because it's listed as a ratio and you don't know what the baseline is, you can't really translate it to an absolute strength power. It's just giving you a ratio. It's taking the amplitude of the background noise that the receiver hears on that frequency and calculating the ratio of how much greater your signal is than the noise floor locally. So that just gives you a ratio. You'd have to get an absolute value from the guy's station in order to transfer that into absolute numbers and try and figure out what's going on. It doesn't really help much. You know, I mean, if you have a high signal-to-noise ratio, that kind of means that it's a great signal and you should be happy with it. If it has a very, very low one, it means that you're just skating the noise floor and it's difficult to read. So, I you know, I mean, it's not really that important, I don't think, to kind of try and figure out. You're never going to get anyone who gives you the absolute amount of energy in your signal, how many microwatts is received. It's just, you know, I don't know of anyone who kind of does things like that. You know, if they give you the S value and how it's calibrated and such, you can infer that, but, you know, as far as signal-to-noise ratios don't give you absolute numbers. They just give you relative numbers.
So the only thing you can glean from it is the higher the better, and that's it, right?
Yeah, the higher the better. Someone wanted to say something on that subject?
Good evening, Roy. This is Mike, WY2U. Actually, finish the discussion, if you want, on signal-to-noise. I'd like to go back to what you were talking about on the effect of VSWR on the output stage of a transmitter. Go ahead.
Okay. If I somehow lapse and forget, please barge in and remind me, okay?
No problem.
Okay, now, back to you, Rich. You know, there's not a great deal to be gained to kind of know the S unit that the guy is reporting, because that's also based on a lot of different variables, which includes his antenna system. You know, if the guy's got a little whip out of the second floor window of his building, he's going to have most likely a different signal strength versus if he had an antenna farm next to his house with massive towers and massive antennas all over the place.
So you can't make a statement like, like to increase the S units, one S unit, the signal-to-noise ratio has to go up by 10 or 20. You can't make a statement like that at all?
No, they don't correlate. Your noise floor is your noise floor. It's more based on your environment and your antenna and your receiver. It, the only thing that you can remotely affect to the other guy is the signal strength, the absolute signal strength. If you quadruple your amplitude, if you go from a 100-watt transmitter to a 400-watt transmitter, that should cause a 1S unit increase in his receiver. The noise floor should not change if your signal strength increases. Again, your signal strength is primarily based on you and propagation conditions. His noise floor is based upon his setup and environment and depending upon the frequency propagation conditions.
So the noise floor doesn't affect S units at all, other than it increases them the higher the noise is.
I'm not quite sure I'm getting you. The noise floor should have no real effect on the S unit of the signal you are receiving. All it does is kind of indicate that is obviously if the signal strength of the receiving signal is below your noise floor, unless you're using a Joe Taylor algorithm, you shouldn't be able to hear it. As you raise your transmitting power, the receiving station should be able to see an increase in the signal strength of your transmission, but it will not or should not have any effect on the baseline noise floor on that frequency.
Okay, so the baseline noise floor could be like an S4, right? Or an S5. So your signal has to be an S6 or an S7 to be heard, correct?
Well, you can have an S5.1 or an S5.2 and be able to make out the other signal sometimes, depending upon the general readability. It doesn't have to be an entire S unit above the noise floor, but it has to be above the noise floor.
Okay. That's about it, Roy. Back to you.
Okay, someone wanted to say something?
Yeah, right. Mike WY2U. I wanted to revisit the discussion real quick about the effect of a mismatch on the output stage of a transmitter.
Sure.
All right. This is not terribly understood, but you got to realize that mismatches sometimes are misleading. For example, if you have, I'm going to just throw some numbers out as an example. Let's say you've got a 100-watt output transmitter looking into a perfect match, so that the VSWR is 1. Therefore, there is no reflected power. Obviously, that's ideal. But let's say now that same transmitter without turndown is now looking into a 3-to-1 VSWR. 3-to-1 VSWR corresponds to 25% reflected power. With no access to an antenna tuner, that would imply 75 watts gets delivered to the load, whether it's an antenna or whatever, and then 25 watts comes back to the transmitter. Now, people would say, well, gee, if the transmitter is designed to put out 100 watts, reflecting one quarter of that back to the output of the transmitter, how is that detrimental to the finals? It sounds like the design is so marginal that it cannot accept that amount of mismatch, which happens to be only about 1 dB. Let me drop. Well, the issue isn't the amount of reflected power. It's the way the final amplifier stage may or may not have been designed. Most transmitters, to keep costs down, do not provide a whole lot of power efficiency margin in the output of a transmitter. It may be on the order of maybe 10 to 20%. Otherwise, you might need bigger tubes or more output transistors, which are costly. Now, the final stage, especially of a final solid-state final transistor output, is very, very tolerant, or not tolerant, I should say, of what happens when the load line changes. It was designed to operate with a certain amount of efficiency and a certain amount of voltage capability, a certain amount of current capability, only into a very small amount of load departure, which usually is about 50 ohms. A 3-to-1 mismatch can have a load variance of, worst case, what would that be? That would be 25 ohms or as high as 100 ohms. In which case, if you go through and convert VSWR to reflection coefficient, you're actually sending back either 50% more current to the transmitter or 50% more voltage, depending on which side of the Smith chart the load VSWR mismatch occurs. That's the problem. The fact that you've got this excess voltage or current somewhere in the output stage degrades the efficiency of the power amplifier so that it's dissipating more power. Not necessarily that it can't handle the 25% reflected power coming back, but that 25% effective power coming back actually greatly affects the load line and greatly diminishes the efficiency of the amplifier, increasing the thermal properties of the output transistor, of course, and that could be detrimental. That is why most manufacturers want to turn down the power into a mismatch. Go ahead, WY2U.
Okay, that's a very good explanation description. In the olden days, the vacuum tubes, I assume, as you mentioned, they were significantly more tolerant of mismatches. But, present days usually have these lovely devices that just shuts most of the power down. So it's smarter than we are. So everyone be thankful for clever engineers.
Yeah, sometimes they may want to overdo it. Some very finicky transistor final amplifiers start to turn down power into a 1.5-to-1, which is only 4% reflected power. That might be kind of extreme, or that might be telltale of maybe a very poor design. Who knows? But 2-to-1 could be detrimental because that's 11% reflected power, 33% reflection coefficient, which means the reflected voltage or current can be 33% higher than nominal. And that could degrade the efficiency tremendously. So I would not be very surprised that most transistor amplifier manufacturers would be very happy to turn down into a 2-to-1 or greater to protect their finals. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think better safe than sorry. I mean, I'm not quite sure what went into the engineering ideas of my linear amplifier that kind of squeals like a pig at 1.5. I just make sure I have an antenna, tuner right next to it so I can give it the signal that it prefers.
By the way, I forgot to mention that. What you're talking about is another issue. Some transistors are inherently unstable. Anytime the output sees anything other than 50 ohms and they take off and oscillate. They may not oscillate close to the output frequency, but the gain at some VHF frequency may be very, very high in the presence of a mismatch. Therefore, they're going to break into an oscillation, usually a parasite somewhere in the VHF range. That's the other problem that could be very, very important. So to prevent that and to prevent the oscillation, by the way, when a transistor amplifier oscillates, it's also dissipating a lot of power. And it can't deliver the power because there's no load to dissipate it. It's just circulating this high voltage or current in the output stage. So I guess to prevent that parasite, what they're doing is preventing you from operating into that mismatch and thereby turning down. Or if you don't turn down, it sits there and oscillating at some lower power level, which is no good either. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, that's like operating at full duty forever and ever. It can't be good for your transistors.
And you slowly deteriorate the effectiveness of a transistor?
Yeah,
transistors can break wire bonds inside the transistor. One transistor has several dies in it, which are parallel connected transistors of smaller volume. When you start delivering power and excess heat in a device, you might break wire bonds and start to remove some of these devices. So where you once had a 100-watt transistor now becomes a 70-watt, then a 60-watt, then a 50-watt, and eventually catastrophically fails. So, yes, you can degrade it there, right?
VHD.
Okay, very good. Yes, Jim?
Would you mind one of my overly simplified explanations at this point?
Sure.
I have no qualms with any of what was said. It's all good stuff. I'm learning. But I think there's a overly simplified analogy that might apply to this that would help us all talk about it. Perhaps the tires on your car are a good example. You put the right pressure in the tires of your car to get better gas mileage. But far more importantly, you put the right pressure in the tires of your car to create durability and reliability in your transportation system. It sounds to me like if we think about SWR that way, it's the easiest indicator of if your system is working and not harming itself, rather than efficiency. Efficiency is great to measure it, but it's more important than the reliability and the durability. That's my look at it, and it doesn't discount anything anybody said. It's not my intention, just to bridge the gap.
Okay, I have no problem with that. I mean, I prefer the part of what's actually doing the problem. The same way that, you know, what's bothering the reliability and life of a tire that's underinflated is that you're going to have a lot more thermal interactions, and the tire is going to overheat when it's being used, and the higher the temperature is for the tire, the shorter the life expectancy of the tire.
Exactly. That's what I was getting at. The life expectancy and the durability of the equipment is more important than how many miles per gallon it gets, both economically and, practically.
Okay, very good. Anyone else have any comment on this particular topic?
KE2GOG.
Yes, what can I do you for today?
Well, I was working on SWR, and I found that if I added more coax, it improved it. And, you know, so I took it. All right, great. I got a better SWR, but why did that work?
Okay. If you have a perfectly set up antenna system, in other words, your antenna is resonant, it has a impedance at the feed point of 50 ohms, and you are feeding it with 50 ohm coax cable, the length of the coax cable will have no effect on the impedance that the transmission line feeds to your transmitter. If you're like the rest of us that are not quite optimum, our antennas are not perfectly resonant, our antenna feed points are not exactly 50 ohms, then the length of your transmission line affects your impedance. And what it does is it rotates your impedance. The impedances are not only absolute numbers. Your absolute impedance is an absolute number, like 50 ohms. But impedances are recorded as both the amplitude and the direction. So there is a angular degree to all impedances. And by increasing the length of your transmission line, you're not changing the absolute impedance, but you are changing the angle. And based upon the angle, the angle has an effect, too, on, especially on a matching device. So I tell this story to everyone, and I'll repeat it today. On 10 meters, I had an antenna that my antenna tuner could just barely not tune. I put a 3-foot jumper in line and rotated the angle of the impedance and put it in an area where my antenna tuner could now perfectly tune. So the length of the coaxial cable will rotate the angle of the impedances, and that will affect your ability to tune it.
Thank you. Okay. That makes more sense on that. I thought I was just changing the value of the impedance to better my SWR. Thank you.
You're welcome.
What does angle of impedance mean?
You remember how we talked about inductors and capacitors and one, the voltage leads and the current follows, the other current leads and the voltage follows. The when you go through a inductive or capacitive circuit, you are breaking the two phases of current and voltage. In a line without any inductance and capacitance, the current and the voltage are totally in phase. The phase angle for that impedance is said to be 0 degrees. If you introduce some capacitance and you introduce some inductance, you will change the phase angle. You will change where in the sine wave the voltage is in relation to the current. So that's what a phase angle, when we talk about impedances, amounts to. There's an absolute value, which is just the total amount of ohms without the angle that we talk about most of the time. But in reality, impedance is not a scalar number. It's a vector number. So it has both amplitude and a direction.
Great explanation, Roy.
Thank you. I tried. Any other questions on this particular topic before we move on?
November 2, Zulu Charlie.
Yeah, how you go? How you doing? John, are you out there? You fell right out of the repeater.
Yeah, Roy, can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah, I just wanted to throw in there. I noticed a lot of times when people have a mismatch and they try adding coax, understanding completely what you're saying about changing the vector angle. The vector angle represents either inductive or capacitive reactance if it's negative or positive. Seems, correct me if I'm wrong, it sort of magically either adds inductance or capacitance to the favorable side. Is that your experience in that?
Well, you know, I try not to use magic in any description because I think it kind of defeats the purpose of rationalism. It's an interesting aspect of coaxial cables, and I like to discuss it because it is not intuitive. I mean, you know, coaxial cables are by definition can be thought of as lumped circuits. They're a series of capacitors and inductors in line. So, you know, they're capable of doing all kinds of seemingly magical things, but there's no hocus pocus. It's just the beauty of science.
No, again, let me just try to be a little more clearer. I've heard people, like you just told your story, you couldn't tune your antenna, you added a 3-foot jumper, bingo, it worked. And I've heard other descriptions of success with that. So getting away from the magically, I'm just using that as just verbiage, it seems that it's almost like homeostasis. It wants to return to normal. And like you say, it's represented by a bunch of capacitors and inductors. I forgot which one is series, which one's in parallel. But it seems to never give you the more of a negative effect. Now, I've never tested this experimentally, but I'm just wanting to know if that has been your information that you receive, your feedback also, seems to never give a worse match.
Well, probably because if it doesn't work for a person, they're not going to tell the story and have it end with, it didn't work for me. You can have too much of a good thing. you can theoretically, I happen to have had a 3-foot jumper that was just the thing for my antenna tuner, but if I had a length of wire that was a wavelength long, the moral of the story would be it didn't do anything because it would have rotated the impedance 360 degrees. So, you know, it's just the stories where the guy was able to rotate it out of a point where their tuning equipment couldn't handle it into a zone where the tuning equipment could. So it's possible to fail. It's not kind of a built-in, self-correcting circuit. If you pick the wrong length of jumper, it's up with still an untunable situation.
Okay, always good to get an explanation and another viewpoint on it, and that's my rationale with it also. That's why I question it. It should work sometimes and it shouldn't. Your story could have been equally as successful if your coax is longer than if you just removed 3 feet. So, okay, yeah, no, it makes sense that we never hear the failures. Why even mention it? All right, Roy, back to you, back to that November 2, so we Charlie on the side listening.
BDH with a comment.
Sure, comment away.
Yeah, just one general comment. The thing that makes transmission lines different from plain old, AC circuit analysis that you may do at 60 cycles is the fact that the time delay becomes comparable to the cycle time. For example, if you take 60, 70 feet of coaxial cable and you fire a pulse down it, that pulse will take about maybe 100 or so nanoseconds, 110 nanoseconds or so to go from one end to the other. Now, if you're working at, say, 5 megahertz, the time for the cycle at 5 megahertz is 200 nanoseconds. So that 100 nanoseconds of delay represents half the cycle time when you're at 5 megahertz. And that whole concept of the distributed circuit, the fact that the propagation time becomes comparable to the cycle time, is what makes transmission lines different to analyze. We have to use Smith charts and stuff like that there to analyze them. When you drop down to, you know, maybe 60 hertz or something, and you're only setting up a circuit that may be 2, 3, 4 feet long, you don't have to worry about propagation delay or compared to the cycle time. The propagation delay is nanoseconds, and the cycle time is measured in tens of milliseconds. But when you're up in the megahertz, reasonable length of cable gives you a propagation time comparable to the cycle time, and that's where all of the interesting stuff comes in.
Okay, thank you for explaining that aspect.
PhD.
Yes, Jim?
So would I be correct in inferring that if you have a situation where changing your coax length improves your match, the actual real problem is that your antenna is the wrong length, not your coax? Is that a bridge too far?
No, as I mentioned before, if you have a perfect antenna system, the length of your coax cable is meaningless. It doesn't rotate anything. It doesn't change anything. It stays at 50 ohms. It's when, unfortunately, you're using a 50-ohm coaxial cable to feed into a antenna feed line, which, because it's not resonant, is not 50 ohms, but something other than 50 ohms, where the length has a significant effect on rotating the angle of the impedance.
November 2, Zulu Chili.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Taking this a step further, after that very nice explanation that the other station gave, I didn't catch the call sign. I'm just curious, is there For instance, with that MFJ, I think it's the 259 antenna analyzer, you can see if your mismatch is positive or negative, so either inductive or capacitive. I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, because I don't work with this stuff daily like some people, there is a like lengthening the coax will add inductance and shorten it, will add capacitance. Is that, does my memory serve me correct, or vice versa, but there is a direct relationship to lengthening or shortening the coax with capacitive and inductance being added or subtracted?
Well, if you're talking about the antenna element, you're correct. If you're talking about the transmission line, you're not correct, because it's not as if you can talk the coaxial cable into being more of one than the other. As I mentioned before, they are they're basically both an inductor and a capacitor simultaneously. So if you lengthen the length of your coaxial cable, you are adding both capacitors and inductors. That supplies it with the 75, the 50 ohms impedance inherent in the coaxial transmission line. So you can change, you could put capacitors and inductors in the antenna elements and change the resonant frequencies electronically without changing the actual mechanical dimensions of the antenna, but you can't do it at the transmission line.
Okay. I'm just thinking about this. The vector, if it's pointing up, I believe it's inductive, and if it's pointing down, it's capacitive. And as the angle changes, it's becoming, let's say it's pointing straight up. As it moves, let's say to the right, it becomes less inductive, less inductive, less inductive, so then it starts becoming capacitive. And so if we're changing the angle of the vector, aren't we that... I'm also saying that we're changing the capacitance and inductiveness relationship of the line.
Yeah, but once again, it's a special case of when you have an inherent mismatch in your transmission line. If you have a perfectly matched transmission line, the length is immaterial to the phase angle. It doesn't change. So it's not solely related to the structure of the transmission line. It has to do with what it's going into, what the antenna feed point is offering as an impedance. And if it's 50 ohms, then there's no real rotation. If there's something other than 50 ohms, then there is.
Okay, some things are harder to follow on the radio. It's kind of one of these things you need a blackboard for. But okay, thank you, Roy.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that I would love to discuss on these technical nets that I've kind of got over and over and over in my mind, and without a slideshow, I am just lost. It's very difficult to explain diagrams on the radio. Some things you can describe, and I'm very thankful for that. But unfortunately, there are some limitations to our operating mode.
Yes, agreed. Yes, but even if it gives you halfway there, it's a home run there. Okay, I'm back to that.
Okay, very well. Once again, if anyone has any tangential comments, questions, or what have you on this subject, hit that push to talk. Okay, Jim, you're next. What do you got for us?
Oh, boy. KD2VHD, this is Jim. This is far more controversial than anything I've ever spoke about on the radio. I'd like to start a discussion on the N-fed half-wave resonant antenna, not non-resonant antennas with tuners, multi-band, but simply N-fed half-wave resonant. Are you game?
I'm game. I wrote a couple of articles on the subject, someplace among the newsletters.
Excellent. So there seems to be a lot of disagreement in the community about that type of antenna, end-fed half-wave resonant antenna, whether it needs a counterpoise, whether it doesn't need a counterpoise, whether it doesn't want a counterpoise, whether the other half of the antenna is relevant or it's not relevant, because the other half of the antenna refers to a quarter-wave antenna, and a half-wave antenna, the other half of the antenna is the antenna. So I'm taking examples from marine antennas that don't have a ground plane, and they're half-wave, and they get a little more complicated than that. I don't truly understand that whole thing, because when you tear apart a marine antenna, it's like, what the heck is going on here? The use case I'm pointing towards is a end-fed half-wave 160-meter antenna. 260 feet long, end-fed, with a 49-to-1. I may be wrong on that. For a resident antenna, it might be different than that. I'm not sure. But I guess the heart of the question is a counterpoise a thing for half-wave antenna or it's not? And I understand there's vast disagreement on the subject. I think that frames the conversation. Back to Roy.
AC2GS. Well, I'll put it to you this way, unfortunately. It sort of depends whether you want to talk about the real world, which I prefer talking about, or the theoretical world. In the theoretical world, I've mentioned this before, if you take a center-fed half-wave resonant antenna, the lowest impedance at any point along that antenna is the center, where it's approximately 50 ohms. You'll get some reports of it being 35 ohms in free space. If you have the ability to put it up into outer space, that's great. I'd love to see it. So it has a impedance. As you slide that antenna feed from the lowest impedance to one side of your antenna, your impedance gets higher and higher. Now, theoretically, when you reach the end of that half-wave antenna, it's no longer a center-fed, it's an end-fed, theoretically, your impedance is approaching infinity, which is a very, very, very large number. In the real world, you never get anywhere close to infinity. By the time you hit to the end of the wire and you measure the input, antenna feed point impedance, it comes out to be 2,000 or 3,000. And that's why people either use a 49-to-1 UNUN or a 64-to-1 UNUN. So that it gets you down from 3,000 ohms to something that an antenna tuner can easily match to a 50 ohms impedance. So that's the problem between theoretical and realistic. In the real world, you may have a counterpoise without recognizing it as a counterpoise. There are UNUNs that have a strap for a random piece of wire, and that's your obvious counterpoise. But in some cases, it doesn't have anything, and it just has a connection to your coaxial cable. And as long as you don't RF choke your coaxial cable, your outer aspect of your shield is producing common mode currents that are operating as a counterpoise for that half-wave resonant end-fed.
In my theoretical mind, the antenna that I was imagining was to have a very effective choke at that point, so that it wouldn't create too many weird lobes, but would work mainly on the wire. And basically ensuring that there was no counterpoise, because it sounds like it's not only not necessary for a half-wave antenna, but it's not beneficial. Again, it's clear that not everybody is on the same page on this, so I'm it's a difficult topic to get a clear, solid answer on, I think.
Well, you know, like all things, like we talked about before about antennas, unfortunately, there are a lot of variables that you can't take into account. The elevation, the positioning, whether it's straight, whether it's crooked, what's in the vicinity of the antenna, all kinds of factors have an effect on the use of the NFED. Most people have something that operates as a counterpoise. You might not need a long counterpoise. You might get away with, you know, if you put your RF choke a foot or two away from the feed point, that may, in that particular antenna, be sufficient to get it operational. There are some people who just randomly place their RF chokes between the feed point and the entrance into their shack because they're more concerned about common mode the currents getting into their equipment in their shack. But, you know, I mean, different people with different slight variations and different environments have found all kinds of different values for their counterpoise, ranging from near zero to all the way to their shack. And, you know, I mean, you can't kind of dismiss those cases for those people. You know, whatever works, works. And like I said before, the short version of the answer is that you probably need some degree of a counterpoise because, again, if your realistic NFED was your theoretical NFED, your impedance would not be 3,000 ohms that it is. It would be infinity. So it's probably not a theoretical half wave. It's a theoretical almost half wave. And so probably, push comes to shove, you're going to need some form of counterpoise. You know, your mileage might vary. But, I mean, I don't think it's an either-or type of a situation. I think it's a matter of degrees. Some require more comment. Yes, John.
A good point of comparison is the commercial vertical antennas. I have an R7 vertical, like this Cushcraft. And it is basically a half-wave vertical. And as such, the driving point impedance is very high. And the matching box does have it's achieved with ferrite transformers in there. But that's how they match the high impedance at the driving point to the 50 ohms. Now, the radials on this antenna are minimal because since the input impedance is high, you just have to have your radials giving you maybe 1/10 or 1/20 of that driving point impedance as your ground reference, as your counterpoise. On the other hand, if you had a quarter wave vertical where the input impedance is relatively low, that's when you have to put up, maybe half a dozen radials to really get a very low impedance reference counterpoise. But the R7 verticals, those by Cushcraft, they are basically half-wave verticals, and they do have, as I said, that matching box which has the unknown end. Also, if the antenna is radiating, you're not going to get infinite impedance. It's going to be high, but it's, if it's radiating, it's not going to be infinite. Okay.
Well, but I think if it was still in your theoretical world, it would be close to infinity. It's 3,000 ohms to me is not close to infinity. Now, I agree with everything you said. I mentioned that the counterpoise, you might be able to get away with a one-foot-long counterpoise, but you'd need something to act as a counterpoise under these particular situations. And John from New Jersey, KB2BD, who joins us in the chat room, mentioned Dave WOLEV's study about NFED half waves, and he mentioned what's a very important fact. These unfortunate 49-to-1 or 64-to-1 unons are inherently rather lossy transforming impedance devices, so you have to kind of factor that. You get the benefit of multi-band operation, but you get a kind of attenuation loss just on the basis of the loss of the udder.
Yeah, plus the fact they are kind of